Next case is Unilock v. Blackboard, 2021-1795. Mr. Walker, this, of course, is a separate case with separate defendant and counsel, but there's no need to go over everything that's gone over again, but you're entitled to use your time as you see fit.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The Delaware District Court in this case dismissed based on its earlier decision in Motorola, holding that the patent owner, Unilock, lacked Article III standing because Fortress theoretically could sublicense the patents. And I'll ask the Court's indulgence to just amplify a few of the key points on that standing argument that we want to make sure that the Court appreciates. This Court has never held that a patent owner at the time of suit lacked Article III standing to sue. There's not a single case that holds that. Instead, it's held in case after case after case that ownership of a patent gives the owner, the patentee, Article III standing to sue for infringement of the patent. That's Aspects, Schwendemann, Pandrol, Mann, Intellectual Property, Omni, and Tenesis, to name a few examples. In particular, Aspects, I think, is the clearest example of this. There, the Court held that a patent owner had standing and overruled the dismissal of its suit for lack of Article III standing, even though a licensee had a virtually unfettered right to sublicense the patent. And there's no way to distinguish that case on the facts. None of the defendants have tried to do that.
Which case is that?
Aspects. It's 434 F3rd, and the relevant discussion is at 337 to 338 as well.
But the key aspects of the Aspects case relate to the question of whether an exclusive license is an assignment, right?
Well, so that was why there was a question as to whether Contour was still the owner of the patent. The Court held a well-reasoned decision that it had not transferred all substantial rights. Therefore, Contour remained the owner of the patent and therefore retained standing to sue, even though a licensee, Chick or Aspects, had a virtually unfettered right to sublicense the patent. And the defendant's only response is to say that Aspects was only talking about Section 281 statutory cause of action and was not speaking to Article 3. They're essentially saying that the Court there overlooked a glaring Article 3 error, and we just do not think that is plausible. The Court at 434 F3rd 1339 described the District Court's dismissal for lack of standing, and it pointed to page 26 of the District Court's slip opinion. And on that page, the District Court said three times it was dismissing for lack of constitutional standing and not for a mere failure to follow statutory requirements. That is why it held that it could not be fixed by adding another party. Aspects was addressing Article III standing, and it held that the patent owner had Article III standing.
But it held that the agreement was a license, not an assignment.
Yes.
It didn't deal with the loss of right to sue by the grant of a non-exclusive license, which is our case.
I think it made very clear, I think it said twice, that it emphasized that the license, which was held not to be an assignment, gave the licensee a virtually unfettered right to sublicense. And it nonetheless held that Contour was the owner and that it had standing to sue. And the fact that there was that unfettered right to sublicense had been the basis for the District Court finding that there was a lack of Article III standing. And, well, that makes sense because, as Mr. Lampkin said, and I won't belabor here, Section 154 gives the owner of the patent the right to exclude others from practicing the invention. And it doesn't disappear. That right doesn't disappear, and the injury that comes when unauthorized infringers invade that right, just because someone else theoretically could but never does sublicense the patent. I don't lose the right to exclude burglars from my home just because I've told my son that he can invite over anyone he wants. And that's just the nature of the right to exclude. So long as you remain the patent owner, you have that right to exclude. And I think Pandrol said it really clearly, that establishing ownership of a patent that has been infringed satisfies the requirements of Article III standing. And that's the rule that should govern in these cases. The contrary decisions of the District Courts, Google and Motorola and here, should be reversed. And if there is a reversal in Motorola, there also has to be a reversal here, because the decision here was simply based on Judge Connolly applying his decision in Motorola to the essentially equivalent facts in this case.
There's no statement here that the non-binding nature of the Apple case, right?
So there that is true. So we do not have an argument that Blackboard waived in a preclusion argument, but they did forfeit the argument. They had the opportunity to argue that Apple was preclusive before the district court. There was 48 days between the time Apple was decided and when the district court asked for briefing on the question of subject matter jurisdiction. It was a few days later that they submitted their response, did not argue that Apple was preclusive. The district court ruled, and it was not until the first time on appeal that they now argue that Apple should now be the case that is preclusive in this situation. And they had every opportunity. They do not argue they were unaware.
This briefing on subject matter jurisdiction you referred to, is that the same supplemental briefing we were talking about with Mr. Lampkin?
It's not the same, because they're in different cases. Supplemental briefing in Motorola did also address subject matter jurisdiction. But here it was the court said, address whether the court has subject matter jurisdiction, see the Motorola decision. So it was flagging that that was what it was inquiring about, whether Fortress's putative right to sublicense would defeat Article III standing. And the Motorola decision cited Apple a couple of times, and they haven't argued that they were unaware of Apple in some way, or that anything prevented them from...
You're not arguing that forfeiture or waiver should apply more strongly to your case. It kind of rises and falls with the other one.
I think that's essentially true, and because it appears that the district court here may well have just applied Motorola as a matter of issue preclusion, if you affirm in Motorola, that judgment would still stand. But if there is a waiver in Motorola, and we think there is, and there's certainly at least a forfeiture that warrants reaching the article...
Except that we're in the Third Circuit here, and the Third Circuit in that 5 case seems to say, no, there's not a forfeiture.
Well, so nowhere says it's not a forfeiture, and I think the best way of looking at it is, as Mr. Lampkin said, is finding exceptional circumstances that warrant going beyond the usual rule that a court will affirm on alternative grounds only if they were properly preserved before the district court. That's
Where does that Third Circuit case say the exceptional circumstances that justify no forfeiture?
So it... 5 unlabeled boxes itself does not say there are exceptional circumstances, that is Third Circuit law. The Simcoe case is cited in a reply brief.
It's not Third Circuit law in this context. 5 unlabeled boxes is dealing with the specific same issue that we have here. That is waiting to raise collateral estoppel until it's finality. And the Third Circuit says that's fine.
Well, so I don't think it went that far. So it cited Wright and Miller. It said there can be difficulties when different cases are wending to judgment at different times. It's not even clear that that is true here, because these cases, the fact that they're consolidated for or companion cases before this court makes clear that they were on very similar tracks. But even apart from that, it was talking about the difficulties that can arise if you give a preclusion to a judgment
reversed. The government, I think it was, waited until finality to raise the issue, and the Third Circuit said, fine.
In those circumstances, and I think it's important, and these are all things that the court mentioned in its opinion, that they were dealing with mutual estoppel. The cases also arose in two different circuits. So if you had conflicting judgments, there'd be no way to reconcile them absent applying preclusion or hoping for a Supreme Court review. And so in that situation, that may well warrant allowing the government to wait and see.
Your argument, it's not their argument.
It's true. So the specific thing that 5 unlabeled boxes referred to was the problems that could arise if you give preclusive effect to a judgment that is subject to reversal on appeal. But that concern is, I think, not applicable here for two reasons. One, the problem is vastly diminished when every case is going to come up to the same court on appeal. You don't have to start over in Blackboard if you've given Apple collateral estoppel effect and Apple is later reversed, because they're all going to come up to this court, and this court can just reinstate the cases, find that there is Article III standing present. And secondly, Blackboard in particular cannot plausibly raise the concern that it shouldn't have had to raise Apple because it was subject to reversal on appeal, because here it insisted on a judgment based on the preclusive effect of a decision, Motorola, that was still subject to appeal. In fact, they did it earlier in the case as well on an invalidity issue. We asked the district court to stay this case until Motorola was decided on appeal so that it wouldn't burden the court, so that we wouldn't have to come up and potentially come back down upon a reversal in Motorola. And Blackbird refused. That's Appendix 194.
This is all very interesting. It has nothing to do with the reasoning of five unlabeled boxes.
Well, I think it does, because it was concerned.
We put ourselves in a position where we follow regional circuit law on collateral estoppel. I think it's not the right approach, but there it is. And I don't see anything in five unlabeled boxes that suggests that that ruling of lack of forfeiture wouldn't carry over to this case.
Well, I think it was, that ruling was based on potential practical problems that could happen if you apply preclusion based on an opinion still subject to appeal. But here, Blackboard clearly was willing to accept that risk because it insisted on getting a judgment based on the preclusive effect of the Motorola judgment on appeal. And so that, I think, is a very different situation. Also, they raised Wright and Miller in support of the argument that that could be a problem in that situation. Wright and Miller also says, and this was not something that was at issue in five unlabeled boxes, that when you have a settlement, and that is the reason why something is not tested on appeal, that a court should feel free in that circumstance to deny preclusion. That's section 4465.1 of Wright and Miller. And we know the Third Circuit is willing to look to Wright and Miller. There's no reason to think that that situation, when there is a settlement and it hasn't been raised in the district court timely, that in that situation, the Third Circuit would decline to apply preclusion. In my rebuttal, unless there are further questions.
We will hold for rebuttal time for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hughes, you have a very esteemed name in this court.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, and may it please the court, Paul Hughes for Blackboard. If Your Honors will allow, I'd like to start and focus principally on collateral estoppel, but if there's anywhere else the court would like to direct me, I'm happy to answer any questions the court may have. But turning immediately to collateral estoppel, we do believe that five unlabeled boxes does govern the analysis here. And I'd like just to take a moment for the context of this case and the decision below and why it is that five unlabeled boxes teaching applies with full force here. So the context of this case is that Unilog had claims against four different companies, this court's aware, the three parties here, plus Apple. And the position of Unilog in the district court was that the case against Blackboard should be stayed. They said this at appendix page 184 and again at page 190. And the reason they asked for it to be stayed was they explained very clearly what was going to happen in this litigation, that appeals of the Google case, the Apple case, and the Motorola case were going to come to this court, and then whatever decision would result would be a preclusive effect, and so there was no purpose in continuing to litigate against Blackboard at that point. But then, as the court's well aware, after Unilock made those representations, it settled Apple without doing any of the things that it admits it could have done. This is its reply brief in our case at page 24 and 25. It said it had alternatives. It could have sought vacatur. It could have continued with the Apple appeal, as they described, with a high-low settlement, so still essentially settled the bulk of the case, but maintained that case, that portion of the standing issue for a judgment here. Unilock didn't do either of those things. Instead, it settled and rendered a final judgment. And that's where five unlabeled boxes comes in. Because if the rule were that, as Unilock suggests, you know, within days they seem to suggest that if there's another district court decision, you have to run into your district court and ask for issue preclusion or forfeit it if you don't do it, again, within a matter of weeks here is the argument. That suggests that there's going to be a pinball machine when Unilock's got four different cases around the country. Under their theory, not only should we have been saying that there was issue preclusion from Apple, but also from the Motorola decision and from the Google decision, because we didn't know if any of those cases were going to reach finality before the others. That's where the wisdom of five unlabeled boxes comes in, again, looking to Wright and Miller, and says, this is not an unknown situation where you have cases that are progressing. They're both in the courts at the same time, but they're on, you know, slightly different time frames. Again, that's similar here because the Apple case was ahead of the Blackboard case. And the Third Circuit, in understanding what is reasonable conduct for a party to assert a preclusion argument, said that it's perfectly reasonable to allow for one case to reach finality before coming to the court and say you're entitled to issue preclusion from that. Because otherwise, it's subject to a lot of complications of having to go back and unwind everything that's been done. And again, when we have a web of four cases here, I think those concerns are even more heightened than just in the bilateral context that the Third Circuit was dealing with in five unlabeled boxes. So measured against that backdrop, I think that the conduct here was completely reasonable, which is ultimately the analysis that Unilock suggests for the forfeiture analysis. But there's even more, I think, that goes to the reasonableness of Blackboard's conduct here. And at appendix page 188, this is our response, and let me touch on Judge Hughes's question about the procedural posture here. This was not in response to a motion that we made. This was Judge Connolly in District of Delaware, who had decided the Motorola decision, issued a sua sponte order saying, bringing the party's attention to his recent Motorola decision, asking each party for 750-word letter briefs, asking the question of, do we have standing in view of Motorola? And what the key question that Judge Connolly made clear, I think, in the subsequent orders he was trying to understand is there anything that is factually different about Motorola that would mean that we would have a different result here? And as Blackboard stated in the letter to the court, again, this is at page 188, Blackboard simply didn't know all of the particulars underlying the Fortress Agreement because it didn't have discovery. And it had asked the question of Unilock's counsel, is there anything different about this case that would mean the other decisions don't control? And Unilock hadn't given it an answer. So the only way that we now know that these other cases, in fact, bind here and raise the same issue is because we've been suggesting and asserting it, and Unilock has acquiesced. They've never suggested that it was a separate issue. But at the time that this was before the district court, we had asked the question of Unilock's counsel whether or not there was anything different. We weren't given a response. So I think it would be difficult to suggest that there's been forfeiture of an argument by not immediately raising it within days before Judge Connolly in response to a sua sponte order directing 750 words about the Motorola decision when we've been asking Unilock for the facts to see if there's anything different, and that's not been forthcoming. But taking it back to the broader legal point, again, this is an issue the Third Circuit has addressed and decided what is reasonable in the context of these particular circumstances. And as that court holds, it's reasonable to wait for the appeals to conclude so you don't, again, have this kind of pinball game of having to go back and forth as the cases wend their way. This was not unknown to Unilock. It repeatedly told the district court here and the other courts that these cases were going to go up together. They knew that they were going to get a decision in these cases. And so when they made the decision to settle Apple without having any form of vacatur or without continuing that case, that has direct collateral estoppel consequences. To the court's question, is there anything that we should make of the non-mutual aspect of collateral estoppel? We don't think there is. Ultimately, I think this turns on a fairness inquiry. One could imagine circumstances which application of non-mutual collateral estoppel could be deemed unfair, particularly if what you're trying to find estoppel on is some trivial issue that was only lightly litigated, wasn't at the forefront, or there would be some other kind of surprise to the party. And there is some flexibility the courts could apply in that context. But in this case, where Unilock was well aware that it was the exact same issue, it was hotly contested, it was bringing that case to the district court's attention, there's nothing remotely unfair about saying that its decision to settle, render that case final, has immediate preclusive effects. So again, the touchstone analysis here is fairness, and I don't think there's any real concern. Now, the Wright and Miller quote that Mr. Walker points to, I think what's important is when you continue that quote, he's citing the quote, part of Wright and Miller, that says, settlement of a prior action pending appeal may defeat preclusion. That's the point they discussed in our brief. But this quote continues, and Wright-Miller says, but the Supreme Court has made it more difficult to avoid preclusion by agreeing to have the judgment vacated. And what so this is citing back to U.S. Bancorp, where the Supreme Court has made it more difficult to obtain vacatur of a judgment on behalf of a settlement. And Wright-Miller is suggesting if you don't have that vacatur, you're going to have a difficult time arguing that you don't have a preclusive effect. Now, we cite to the Sixth Circuit's decision in Watermark, which, again, I think is applying a pretty broad federal standard. It's looking at state law, but it's collecting cases from around the country, including the Third Circuit's decision in Sentinel. And I think that court gives a fairly thorough policy treatment of the reasons why you have collateral estoppel in this context of a settlement and no reason not to apply it, because you don't want to incentivize parties who have the first case that might not be going their liking, essentially, you know, buying their way out of it and then taking a second bite at the apple in some other case, perhaps against a less resourced defendant or a less resourced party or whatnot. The Sixth Circuit gives a pretty thorough explanation why all of the policy interests underlying issue preclusion about judicial efficiency and having a single opportunity to fully litigate out issues is completely vindicated if a party in the first case chooses, instead of having it stay in court and carrying that case through to an appeal, instead settles and renders the lower court's decision final. Again, there's hardly anything unfair about that. And if this court concludes that there's nothing unfair about applying issue preclusion, and we think there's really no basis here whatsoever to find forfeiture on these facts, again, Blackboard filed no affirmative motion. The brief to this court was the first brief that we have filed since the court's sua sponte order, apart from the 750-word letter that Judge Connolly directed to be specifically about standing and Motorola. I don't think there's any basis on that record to find forfeiture in view of the Third Circuit's decision with five unlabeled boxes. So again, if we set aside forfeiture, if we set aside the fairness objections, Unilock doesn't have any other basis to resist collateral estoppel. Its brief, I think, concedes that the four classic elements of collateral estoppel are all satisfied in this case. They don't challenge that in their position here. So again, if collateral estoppel is not forfeited, and if fairness is satisfied, I think that would fully resolve this case and properly resolve the issues before the court. Let me pause. Your Honor, I'd be happy to answer any other questions the court may have, or I can rest there.
No one ever loses points by not using up all their time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Walker has some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors. There's no question that under this court's decision in Pharmacy and the well-established rule that a district court decision has immediate preclusive effect as soon as it's issued, allow them to raise the argument that Apple was preclusive as soon as that decision was issued and the district court asked them to address subject matter jurisdiction. They absolutely could have argued in their response to the court's briefing order that we were precluded by virtue of Apple or by virtue of Motorola, which they also didn't assert, was preclusive and prevented us from asserting subject matter jurisdiction. Mr. Hughes said it was only 750 words they were allowed to brief. They only used 419 of the words. That's almost an entire 28-J letter they left on the table. And they spent about a third of the letter talking about unrelated sanctions motions that the district court had not asked them to raise. There's no question they could have raised Apple in that briefing, and that was a fair and reasonable opportunity. Mr. Hughes also says that it's reasonable to wait for case to reach finality. And maybe in some cases that is. Five unlabeled boxes was willing to overlook a failure to raise preclusion before a district court. But the reason it did it was because there could be problems to apply preclusion to a decision still subject to review. But Blackboard did exactly the opposite with respect to Motorola. That decision was still subject to appeal before this court, just heard argument in it. But they insisted on getting a judgment based on Motorola, fully aware of the risk of getting preclusion based on a decision that is still subject to appeal. And we think it's a bit rich for Blackboard to now say, oh, well, that should nonetheless excuse us for not raising preclusion based on Apple, despite having the opportunity to do it. That, I think, alone is sufficient to distinguish this case from five unlabeled boxes, as well as the fact that on the merits,
of preclusion, non-mutual preclusion here. Wright and Miller, which is the authority that five unlabeled boxes itself cited, says that settlement can, if it is leads to the foregoing of opportunities to test a judgment, that a court should feel free to deny a preclusive effect. Yes, it recognizes that the Supreme Court in Bancorp says you shouldn't, as a matter of course, vacate judgments after they settle, but this court in the Aquamarine decision observed that that doesn't answer the question of whether you should give it collateral estoppel effect in a later case. That's an equitable decision based on an equitable decision, especially in the non-mutual context. And here, both the fact that it was never raised below and that there was an intervening settlement that resolved disputes in about 30 different cases when no one had properly preserved a preclusion argument, I think are ample reasons not to apply preclusion based on Apple. And for this court to reach the merits of the standing issue, the district courts here relied on. And one last point I want to make is that if this court reaches the merits of the Article III standing question and says that Fortress's putative right to sublicense does not defeat a patent owner's Article III standing, that holding should apply in all of these cases. So if Motorola waived preclusion, as the court should find, then that holding, that merits holding, would apply here. Because under Herrera versus Wyoming, the Supreme Court's decision, a repudiated decision cannot have collateral estoppel effect. If this court repudiates the holding of Apple by saying that a sublicense right does not defeat Article III standing, Apple cannot be given collateral estoppel effect for that reason as well. So in all these cases, the court should reverse. Is there further questions?
No. Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.